I hope everyone can hear me at the back. Do interrupt me if the volume is not right. So, in 1938, Helen Ferguson, Hume County's housewife and writer of conventional novels, was admitted to a Swiss psychiatric clinic after a suicide attempt and a severe psychiatric breakdown. When she emerged again, she was barely recognisable, transformed from a plump brunette to an emaciated platinum blonde. She'd taken the name of her own fictional character and become Anna Cavan. From that point forward, her writing style was dramatically altered. It became bleaker, starker, dealing with issues of madness and despair. And from that point onward, she would be a heroin addict for the rest of her life and surround herself in mystery and enigma. This is the story of Anna Cavan, as it's been told and retold in countless magazine articles, book reviews, on flyleaves, to an extent in the two biographies of her life. My research into Cavan, which began with my PhD on her, to some extent contradicts that story, and so I'm going to retell the story of Cavan tonight, to some extent. It's really, I hope that people had a chance to go and have a look at the Cavan element of the exhibition, because it's a real pleasure to see her included in this exhibition, alongside other writers and intellectuals. Certainly my research into Cavan has placed her in this field more prominently. And so that's really what I'm going to talk about tonight. Cavan as an intellectual, and Cavan also as a political thinker and writer, hence the title of my talk. This picture, I should introduce it, is a photograph of Cavan taken in 1941 by the photographer Walker Evans during her stay in New York. So I'm just going to very briefly, I'm not sure if you can see this, I'm probably understanding something. This is a bibliography, I'm not at all sure that you can see it. But I'm not going to talk in great detail about her fiction tonight, but just wanted to give a bit of an overview of it. You see here the six Helen Ferguson novels that she published before her name was changed, before she began to publish under the name Anna Cavan. And the narrative of these six novels has very much been that they were autobiography, that they were conventional novels. And certainly, when she began to publish as Anna Cavan, there was a big break in her style, and she began to formulate that more distinctive Cavan voice that perhaps those of you familiar with her work know. But I think it's worth saying that these novels were not so conventional. They were psychological novels, and they already dealt with very controversial issues, madness, incest, etc. Some of them are really very strange. And later, as Anna Cavan, she would go back and revisit the style of her earlier work. She would also go back and rework some of her earlier plots and her earlier novels. So this break between the Helen Ferguson writing and the Cavan writing, it's not so stark as it's been made out to be. Just a little quote here. Dawn mentioned Peter Owen Publishers earlier. Peter Owen published Anna Cavan from the mid-1950s, and she did struggle throughout her life at times to find a publisher. Peter Owen very much championed her and continued to champion her and continued to publish her work. And this is a letter in the archives from Cavan to Peter Owen, which I just wanted to highlight. She writes, "I've often started autobiographical things, but never finished them. It's an idea I find attractive, but difficult to know just how to handle it." And I just wanted to highlight again there that Cavan herself claims not to have written autobiography. And so a lot of the narrative of her life, which draws evidence from her fiction, I think is on shaky ground there. She didn't claim that she was writing autobiography, although she drew on the events of her life quite profoundly for her fiction. So, sit again. Mention again that something I won't mention in great detail tonight is her painting. She did paint throughout her life. In the mid-1920s, she studied at the London Central School of Arts and Crafts, and she exhibited, but rarely. My sense is that painting is something that she did more for herself and that she shared paintings with friends. This image is now in private ownership, but it's become quite an iconic representation of her paintings. One thing that I thought I would mention, this image here is titled Self-Portrait, and the one that's on display in the museum is also titled Self-Portrait. Kafan's portraiture, I feel, has also been subject to the same issues as her fiction, in that any painting of a woman is considered to be a self-representation. In the same way that with her fiction, any representation of a female character is often attributed to her. But so I'm going to just cover the early part of Kavan's life very quickly. I'm more interested in keeping with Lisa Opinionese's book, Mad, Bad and Sad, Women in the Mind Doctors, in representing to you Kavan's relationship with psychiatric practitioners throughout her life. The main protagonists of this story will be Maxwell Jones, who would go on to be one of the founders of the therapeutic community, and whom Kavan worked with at the Mill Hill Emergency Hospital in the 1940s. Carl Theodore Blut, Kavan's psychiatrist and close friend, who she would also co-author a book with. Ludwig Binswanger, the Swiss existential psychotherapist, who she would be treated by in both 1947 and 1948 at the Bellevue Sanatorium in Kreuzlingen. I'm going to mention also briefly R.D. Lang, because a lot of what I'm going to be driving at this evening suggests that Kavan's work, both in her journalism and in his fiction, presages the work of the British anti-psychiatry movement. So he's a sort of a figure here, although as far as I'm aware, there was no contact between the two of them. Also, just because we're here, and I suspect that some in the audience might be more psychoanalytically minded, I'll mention in passing Sigmund Freud. Because, again, with any discussion, I think, about psychotherapy in the 20th century, he's always in the background, if not the foreground. So, very briefly, the early part of Kavan's life. Kavan was born Helen Emily Woods in 1901 in Cannes. Her parents were British expats, and they were very wealthy. So Kavan spent much of her childhood either looked after by nannies or in boarding schools, and there's a sort of a narrative around her sense of being a very lonely and neglected child. Although I think it's worth pointing out that perhaps her childhood wasn't that different from other children of her social class, of her time. Kavan's father committed suicide when she was 10 years old. He jumped from the prow of a ship in Mexico. Although there was very little in Kavan's writings about her father. He's not really referred to in the correspondence that's available. Her mother remarried again to Joseph White, and then some years later she remarried Hugh Tevis. And so Kavan herself, after coming through school, was living with her mother, and then married Donald Ferguson. He was 11 years her senior when she was 18 years old. This is a sort of curious move on Kavan's part. Ferguson was older than her. He was also from a very solidly middle-class background, and not necessarily an obvious choice for her. I think my sense is that perhaps she was keen to escape the family home and to have some independence. She went with Ferguson to Burma, where he held a mid-ranking post in the British colonial railway there, but the marriage wasn't a success. And again, in the biographical accounts of Kavan, a lot's been drawn from her fictional representations of this marriage in Burma. But I don't want to read too much into that. So the family returned to England in 1923 with their young son Brian, who had been born in Burma. But Donald Ferguson then went back to Burma, and the marriage was pretty much over. Brian didn't live with Helen as she was then. He was cared for by nannies. So in the 1920s, as I mentioned, Cavan studied at the London Central School, and she also in the mid-20s met Stuart Edmonds, an artist, and remarried. And during her marriage in 1928, and during her marriage to Stuart Edmonds, that's when she published those first six novels, but under her previous married name, Helen Ferguson. Late in 1935, she gave birth to another child, a daughter, Margaret, who died very quickly after that, within a matter of days, possibly weeks. And the couple adopted another child, Susanna, effectively to replace the child that they had lost. I'll mention her again a bit later. So it seems that the Edmonds marriage began to break down around 1938. And so this is when Cavan was first admitted to a psychiatric clinic. We don't know that much about the clinic in Switzerland, only that it catered for affluent individuals. It was paid for by her mother. And certainly it did influence her asylum peace stories. But I think the point to make about the tale of her dramatic transformation is that this was first introduced by Cavan's good friend, Bruce Davies, and literary executor, in an article that was published not long after her death. And Davies talks about meeting her again after her time in the clinic and how he walked past her, didn't recognise her. She asked him to only call her Anna Cavan. But I think what's worth pointing out is that there was a gap of several years in between the two meetings of Davies and Cavan. So, yes, she lost some weight, whether or not that was due to her psychological breakdown or not. She changed the colour of her hair. But the taking on of the name Anna Cavan was actually a very slow process. I call her Cavan. But so she began to publish under the name Anna Cavan in 1940, but it wasn't until that publication brought her critical acclaim, after she travelled quite widely for a number of years, that she began to use it in her personal life. After the breakdown of the marriage, Cavan returned to London. The marriage was pretty much over. Stuart Edmonds was already in the midst of an affair with the woman that he would marry after his divorce from Cavan. And around this time, Cavan met Ian Hamilton, who was a writer who lived in New Zealand and was in the UK overseeing the production of his play. Cavan and Hamilton began an affair and they began to travel together. Late 1939, they went to Scandinavia, but the Second World War followed very hot on their heels and they were forced to leave Norway very quickly. Then they travelled through North and Central America, settled in California for 6 months, and then they parted company. Hamilton went back to New Zealand, and Cavan sailed on for South Africa to join her mother, who was living there at the time. On the boat to South Africa, Cavan began another affair with Charles Fuller, who was a wealthy patron of the arts, American patron of the arts. The couple were travelling. Fuller was travelling towards China, Cavan was on her way to South Africa, but they were effectively stopped in their tracks due to wartime restrictions on travel. And so the couple travelled around the Dutch East Indies for a while, and then returned to New York, where Cavan lived for a short while under the patronage of Charles Fuller. She met some very interesting people there. She was introduced to Sylvia Townsend Warner, to Louis McNeice. She, as I mentioned, spent some time with Walker Evans and Jim McGee, his writing collaborator. But it was a very sort of turbulent time for her. She was sort of having fabulous times, but also very difficult times, attempting suicide twice in that period, that there's evidence for. And so she was very unhappy and was very glad when she heard from Ian Hamilton that he was willing to have her come and join him in New Zealand. And Jennifer Sturm has done some work, she's a New Zealand scholar, on Cavan's time in New Zealand, and it seems that that was really a very peaceful interlude in her life. She didn't have access to heroin or any drugs, she wasn't drinking heavily. The couple were very self-sustaining, they grew a lot of their own food, and she had a very peaceful existence there. But Ian Hamilton was strongly pacifist, as was Cavan. And Cavan left New Zealand after 2 years because they were very much concerned that he was about to be interned for refusing to fight, which did indeed happen after Cavan had left. New Zealand were very harsh and conscientious objectors during the Second World War. And so Cavan left Hamilton there, and despite plans to go back, she never did. I've just put a quote here because I think it's just worth noting how extraordinary it was that Cavan attempted this trip around the world during the Second World War. It was very difficult for her often to find visas to travel because people just didn't. I wanted to include this first quote very briefly. This is a letter from Cavan to Ian Hamilton about her journey back from New Zealand to the UK. She was planning to stop off there and then again try to get to her mother in South Africa. And one interesting thing about Cavan's correspondence is she is often very self-involved when she's writing, and sort of the daily trials of her life are felt very deeply by her. And yet when she finds herself in this most extraordinary situation of danger, she's really very sort of laissez-faire about it. She writes, "The ship beside us was torpedoed in daylight, and that was an extraordinary thing to watch. Her back was broken, and she seemed to be almost in two, with a very tall, black, evil-looking smoke standing over her like a demon. It was extraordinary, but not really shattering at all. Of course, everything that happens always seems slightly familiar because of the movies." And so here we see that sort of characteristic derealization that writers talking about shocking images of war often describe. So I just wanted to include that there. So Cavan returned to London, and she was forced to settle there. She couldn't get a visa to travel on to New Zealand. And she was also forced to find war work. So again, a very short quote to give you a sense of her feelings returning to London. "Oh, but it's dreary here, the war and the winter, the blackout, the dismal faces, the cold, the shabbiness, the feeling of death in the air." But Cavan's time in London from the very end of 1942 and through for the rest of the war was some of her most productive and interesting. She was writing during her travels, she was writing in New Zealand, and she really started writing a lot back in London. So I wanted to include this because I wasn't sure how many people with a very specific interest in psychoanalysis would be here, but I thought it was worth mentioning, although it's not, I don't have a huge amount of information about this, that Cavan did undergo some psychoanalysis. This is a quotation, a letter in 1943 where she writes about, "Since I got out," she says, "since I got out of that very sticky patch of depression with the help of Kafka's friend at the Tavistock Clinic." And this is the only reference I've found to Cavan's treatment at the Tavistock Clinic. I'm fairly certain there was a very drastically reduced wartime operation at the clinic during those years. And I'm fairly certain that Kafka's friend is a reference to the Czech doctor, Erwin Popper. He's not a very prominent psychoanalyst. I don't know a lot about him. I'd be fascinated to hear more if people did. But it seems, you know, Cavan hadn't been in the country for a long time at that period. So my sense is she didn't undergo what we might consider to be a traditional, ongoing analysis, that she had some sort of shorter treatment at the Tavistock Clinic. And certainly, even from the mid-1930s, Cavan's starting to refer to Freud in her fiction, use Freudian terminology. So my sense is she was interested in Freud, but that perhaps she wasn't much more conversant with his work than your average sort of intellectual of the time. But I wanted to point that out because here we are in the Freud Centre. So in 1943, Cavan did some freelancing for the BBC in London. She hoped to find a permanent job there, but that fell through for her. She attempted to gain custody of the child, Susanna, that I mentioned that she'd adopted. That was very much blocked by her then-husband, Stuart Edmonds. They were going through the divorce process. She managed to see Susanna once, and found a lawyer and felt hopeful about it, but I think at some point the objections to her having contact with that child because of her psychiatric difficulties meant that that was out of the question for her, and she doesn't mention Susanna again in her correspondence after that time. But the divorce from Stuart Edmonds does go through. So Cavan was forced to find war work. She began working for the Red Cross in a library, basically fixing and mending books. But then something interesting happens in mid-1943, and this is where I'm going to touch on Maxwell Jones. Cavan writes a letter again to Hamilton. The Ian Hamilton archives are really fascinating for information about her life at this time. She writes, "I've now got a job which is extremely interesting and worthwhile, working with a psychiatrist in a big war hospital for neurotic cases. It would take too long to explain how I got into this. It was mainly through asylum peace." And I find this quote really fascinating. So Cavan is referring here to the work that she did in the Mill Hill Emergency Hospital, which was one of two military neurosis centres which the Maudsley Hospital effectively split into during the war. But what I find really interesting is that Cavan somehow finds this work through her own writing. My sense is that somebody, Maxwell Jones possibly, who she works for, was reading her work, and because they were interested in her work, she somehow has an authority to speak and to work in a psychiatric domain. And this is something that I hope to return to again. It seems to me that the psychiatric practitioners that Cavan came into contact with not only perhaps influenced her, but perhaps her fiction was interesting to them. So one thing that the war did to the worker at Mill Hill was that the non-trained female workers were brought in, a lot of them artists or writers or creative in some way, and so it seems that Cavan was one of these women who was brought in and was allowed to become very involved in the work despite lack of training. While she was there, she did start studying for the diploma in psychological medicine, and she became very interested, in psychiatric medicine, and she became very interested in psychiatric terminology and starts to use a lot of it in her correspondence. So here she describes, "My main job is interviewing the patients one at a time and putting them through a sort of questionnaire which is designed to bring out a general impression of personality and to trace the development of effort syndrome. I spend about 1.5 to 2 hours on each man, and it's really like a sort of condensed miniature analysis each time." Another reference to psychoanalysis, obviously. "Quite extraordinarily interesting and exhausting too." So Cavan threw herself into this work. She was absolutely fascinated by it. And her time working with soldiers suffering from combat fatigue is hugely reflected as well, I think, in her stories of the time that she publishes in journals and which are collected in the 1945 collection I Am Lazarus. The interesting thing about this, and I will just, even though we don't have a picture of him, I'll return to our Maxwell Jones slide. Maxwell Jones at the time was quite a young psychiatrist, and he would go on to do very interesting, innovative things later in his career as one of the first founders of the therapeutic community. So later in his career, he would very much start to look at breaking down the more traditional relationship between psychiatrist and patient. At the time, as I say, he was very young, but he's definitely wanted to involve workers like Cavan in a more sort of direct and human way in terms of their contact with the patients who were there. Effort syndrome was the condition that was being treated at Mill Hill, and that was a sort of a newer term for a condition which was first identified during the American Civil War and has been known by various different names, primarily soldier's heart, sometimes DaCosta's syndrome. And the symptoms of that syndrome are basically a sort of shortness of breath, tightness or heaviness in the chest. When it was first discovered during the Civil War, it was considered to be some sort of cardiac problem experienced by soldiers. And many of the, but by the time we get to the Second World War, Effort syndrome is identified as being psychosomatic. and identified as a type of war neurosis. So much of what was done at Mill Hill was done to sort of educate the men who were there about their condition, and that was really used as a, I mean, I don't want to suggest that it was all a very therapeutic environment. Certainly it was a military neurosis centre, and the aim of the centre was to get men back to fighting. But there was a very educational aspect to the work that was done there, and that hence, you know, this sort of discussion that, that Caban goes into. Just here, again, to sort of illustrate Caban's interest in her work there and the feeling that she had for the men that she was dealing with, another quotation. One of the boys was telling me the other day about a traumatic experience he had when a very great pal of his was badly wounded, and in the course of his description he said, "I could only smooth the hair back out of his eyes and say, 'Poor Jimmy, that's about all one can do for anybody else in this world.'" I found that very moving. And it's interesting, again, to note that a lot of Caban's stories from around this time do feature soldiers suffering from war neurosis. And I feel they are some of her most moving, touching stories. So I'm going to read some quotes, which I don't have on the handout, from an article that Caban published in 1944, and this really called The Case of Bill Williams. So that appeared in Horizon in February 1944, and this really it was the pointer for me towards an attitude of Caban's, a political attitude that I would like to call anti-psychiatry, that I very much feel presages the British anti-psychiatry movement. And I'll return to Maxwell Jones because he's a figure in this article as well. So The Case of Bill Williams was a three-part article appearing in Horizon, and in it Caban wrote the first part of the article. She introduces the character of Private Bill Williams. He's a fictional character, and in fact he will return again in a story that Caban publishes several months later in an entirely fictional setting. But in the case of Bill Williams, I'm just going to read out, I'm sorry I don't have a slide of this, I'm going to read the opening of it to you. So this was written several months after Caban left Mill Hill. She was offered a job at the literary journal Horizon, and the appeal of that sort of took her away from the work that she'd been enjoying there. At Horizon she was an editorial assistant, she was able to review books in the journal. So I'm just going to start with the beginning of The Case of Bill Williams. Private Williams is a neurotic case. Society doesn't approve of Private Williams. The hospital staff takes a very poor view of him. Bill Williams is unpopular with the nurses, and the doctors are anxious to get him out of their wards. They say he is a bad influence on other patients. They have no time for him because, in spite of pep talks and electrical treatment and benzodrine tablets, he persists in being resentful and unfriendly, apathetic and slovenly, uncooperative and bad-tempered, rebellious and disintegrated. She goes on. Inevitably, right from the start, the social machine is the enemy of the individual Bill Williams. Every door closing, every form filled in, every official, every broadcast, every regulation, every propaganda slogan is a munition in the war, society versus Bill Williams. So the article goes on to conclude that Caban predicts that the fate of mankind is in peril unless, quote, a tonic epidemic of madness blazes across the world like a comet and blasts all the machinery into smithereens. So Bill Williams was an extraordinarily polemic piece of writing in which Caban's, at the time, very controversial sort of anti-war feelings came across. And also, as I'm trying to suggest, an argument against traditional psychiatric treatment and an argument for the fact that it's society which is mad, and that Bill Williams, as the mad individual, is making a sort of a valid critique of social conformity. The second two parts of The Case of Bill Williams were, this is what's extraordinary about it, were responded to by first of all, Maxwell Jones, who's a working psychiatrist, and the second part by Edward Glover, a very well-respected psychoanalyst. And they basically go on to give an opinion and a diagnosis about this fictional character. Here you can see Pavan says in her correspondence, Maxwell Jones is replying to my Bill Williams outburst with the orthodox state-employed psychiatrist's attitude. The result should be provocative, if nothing else. And Maxwell Jones does come across, I think, as very reactionary in his Bill Williams piece, very much against Bill Williams' desire to be an individual. Edward Glover, who's an interesting character psychoanalytically, gives a more sort of nuanced, middle-of-the-road approach. But it's extraordinary that Cavan manages to make this fictional character come to life in a way in Horizon, and he strikes a chord with the readers. The letters in the next edition of Horizon provoke a good response from readers. One of whom writes in to say, "I am Bill Williams," in a sort of "I'm Spartacus" moment. I feel that I understand what you're getting at here. So I'm going to move on, I think, to the next Mind Doctor. Oh. I was going to include this. I'm a bit short of time, actually. Perhaps we'll come back to this. I haven't mentioned much about Cavan's drug use. Maybe I'll just touch on this very, very briefly. Cavan's known to have been a heroin addict throughout her life, but she wasn't really involved, as far as I understand, in drug culture in particular. She was very discreet about her heroin use. But during the Second World War, I've found some interesting archival stuff on her cocaine use, actually. And I really liked this postcard, which is in private ownership now. Because it's a postcard, Cavan sort of using a sort of very, very, very thinly veiled wording here. So she writes to Peter Davies, who's Rhys Davies' brother, "Dear Peter, your cake shop has a notice up, no new customers. Do you think it would be any good if you introduced me as a friend of yours? The situation regarding cake for Horizon is getting desperate." And so in accounts of Horizon at this time, Cavan is very much described as being unpopular, not really fitting in. Her drug use obviously was a problem there, and that's recounted. But what I find interesting about that quotation is the sense that perhaps she is supplying cake to others at Horizon. Here's a letter again to Cyril Connolly that she writes from a visit while she's working at Horizon to Torquay. And she says, "Please don't suspect me of coming back to buy coke." So obviously her drug use is known. But I'm going to just skim over that quite quickly and get to Carl Theodore Blut. So Blut began to treat Cavan as her psychiatrist again in 1943, and he is an absolutely fascinating character. Very little is known about his psychiatric method. Certainly he is interested in Freud. I'll go on to say a little bit about that. But he is a private practitioner. Many of his patients are artists, writers, intellectuals and creatives. He treated David Gascoigne, the painter, George Barker, Julian Trevelyan, Peter Watson, who Cavan knew at Horizon, and also Arthur Koestler. This is the only photo that I have available of Blut. And he is this sort of shadowy, Nosferatu-like figure. I've taken this from the cover of one of Peter Owen's editions. He is very mysterious. He was born in Berlin in 1892, and his first passion was as a poet and a playwright. He studied literature and philosophy in Jena, where he associated with other artists and writers, particularly Ernst Ludwig Kirchner. His first collection of poems was published in 1918, and he continued to write while he studied medicine and began working in German hospitals, specialising in psychiatry. So Blut was a public critic of violence and totalitarianism, stated particularly in his plays, which were published in Germany in 1930 and 1933. And so by 1933, his works were included in the Nazi book burning, his plays were banned, and his medical license was revoked. So he was pretty much forced to flee Germany. He had no way of having an income there. So he left Germany in 1934 with his Jewish wife. They travelled in South America and came to Britain in 1936. He qualified again to practice medicine in Edinburgh and then moved to London, where he opened his private psychiatric practice. The relationship between Blut and Cavan is a complicated one. He started as a psychiatrist, but they were absolutely, certainly friends for the rest of his life until his death in 1964, which Cavan was absolutely devastated by. They did have difficulties along the way, partly because Cavan, in the first years of their association, refused to pay her bills for him. So there's quite a lot of correspondence in the archives between Blut and Cavan, and Blut's wife, who sort of managed his affair, and Cavan's family. There was a sense that maybe there was some sort of psychiatric reason why she didn't want to pay the bills, as opposed to, there was no reason why she couldn't. Her family were very wealthy. But I'm just going to show you here some photographs from the Tulsa archives, so forgive me for the red lines there. They're just an indication of the fact that these were copies from archives. So part of the reason Cavan's described, I think, often as an enigma is that a lot of her correspondence wasn't kept and a lot of her diaries don't seem to exist. It's been suggested that she destroyed these, but then, you know, her flat in London was blitzed. She travelled extensively, so it might be that some of her correspondence was simply lost. What she did keep a hold of were very many pictures, poems, notes and doodles to her by Karl Blut. This one, I mean, I think you get a sense of a woman bending over. This one, also very bizarre, I think this is a man with a pair of forceps pulling, I don't know if it's a baby or some other figure. It's out of a toilet, actually. That's what the German indicates. And I think, really, I really wanted you to see these pictures to get a sense of the incredibly unconventional relationship, patient-psychiatrist relationship that was going on here. I haven't been able to reproduce as many of these as I would have liked, but I'll show you a more innocuous one, because I don't want to give you the sense that they're all shocking. There are sort of people, animals, but there are also phalluses, a lot of doodles of syringes. And so there's a sense that Cavan's drug use was a sort of a subject of playfulness between them. And certainly it's known that Blut supplied Cavan with heroin during his lifetime. And her writing indicates that the two of them believed that it was, to some extent, a form of medication for her psychiatric difficulties. One thing that I did discover that I found very interesting is that Blut himself occasionally used heroin. So there's little I can say, really, about his psychiatric method, because there is very little archival evidence. But the one thing that we do know is that it was through Karl Blut that Cavan was referred to Ludwig Binswanger in Switzerland. Binswanger, I'll talk about a little bit here. He came from a very well-respected psychiatric family. He was the third in his generation to manage the Bellevue Clinic in Switzerland, where he was, where Cavan was treated in 47 and 48. To give you a sense of how well-respected it was, Breuer referred Bertha Pappenheim, who you might otherwise know as Anna Rowe, there, in 1882. And so they were a very well-respected psychiatric family. Ludwig Binswanger that we're interested in, began to become interested when he was studying in psychoanalysis. He was basically a disciple of Jung. And he was there at the meeting of Freud and Jung. So he was strongly influenced by Freud and psychoanalysis, but then he later also became very interested in existential philosophy, which he incorporated into his psychiatric practice. So the interesting thing about the relationship between Freud and Binswanger, and they did have a very cordial friendship, actually, throughout their lives, is that like Jung, Binswanger was appealing to Freud because he came from this very respectable scientific, psychiatric background. But then, sort of ironically enough, Binswanger starts to become interested in existential philosophy and in what and to incorporate a sort of quasi-spiritual element of particularly Heidegger's work into his psychiatric practice. So Freud begins his relationship with Binswanger thinking that this is a very respectable, very scientific person to have on board in psychoanalysis. And in the end, Freud comes to sort of, they disagree theoretically, although they're still very good friends, and Freud starts to talk about Binswanger's need for religion. So it's like Binswanger sort of spirals out of control, further away from the sort of the more scientifically respectable end of of psychoanalysis. So I'm running shorter on time than I'd hoped, and so I won't say too much about Ludwig Binswanger. Blut, as I say, had referred Cavan to the Bellevue. He had also referred a number of other British patients there. And he visited the Bellevue while Cavan was staying there in 1947. Cavan and Blut worked together on a novel, which is very hard to get a hold of now. It was never reprinted in 1949, called The Horse's Tail, which is an allegory which features a Binswanger-esque character and a Cavan-esque character, although that character is a horse. Let me say, that's a very shaky picture of the Bellevue Sanatorium. And also, that's a wood cutting of a portrait of Ludwig Binswanger by Ernst Ludwig Kirchner, who was, as I mentioned, a sort of a compatriot of Blut's. They were good friends, and Binswanger also treated him. So, I feel that I'm running short of time, but I want to just mention very briefly Cavan's time at the Bellevue. I'll skip over this first quote because we're short of time, but I wanted to highlight the fact that Cavan writes of Binswanger. He really has read Asylum Peace and Lazarus and knows them well, which is rather remarkable. So Binswanger's method of existential psychotherapy was very much to sort of to communicate with the patient as a person. My sense is that probably he became familiar with Cavan's work via Blut in preparation for treating her as a patient. But also the fact that he is reading her work again suggests to me that although, you know, we might think about Cavan being influenced by Binswanger, we might also think about Binswanger being interested in Cavan's work. So, I'm going to talk very briefly just to wrap up about Arguli, because I think I'm making some quite large claims here for Cavan as an anti-psychiatrist. Lang, of course, began life as a psychiatrist and then also as a psychoanalyst. He worked for years at the Tavistock Clinic, where one of his major supervisors was Donald Winnicott. And so a lot's been discussed about correspondences in Lang's anti-psychiatric work and object relations theory. But he was also profoundly interested in existential philosophy. And I want to give you this quote here. In later years, when he's describing The Divided Self, published in 1967, which had an enormous impact, he describes it as a sort of soft edge between psychoanalysis and existentialism. The nearest similarity was to Binswanger. So there are correspondences, I feel, in the anti-psychiatric writing of R.D. Lang. So anti-psychiatry is a sort of difficult term to use, in that almost nobody who comes under that terminology, who's been described as an anti-psychiatrist, liked it. They all rejected it out of hand. It was coined by David Cooper in 1967, although even Cooper himself very quickly decided it wasn't a great term. R.D. Lang didn't like it. Foucault, who's often been described as writing in an anti-psychiatric manner, didn't like it. Deleuze and Guattari on the more theoretical end also rejected it. But I do want to make a claim for using it, because it's a useful term to describe a particular intellectual movement post-war, which argued against the traditional psychiatric institution, the traditional relationship of psychiatrist and worker, and it very much argues for madness as being socially constructed, as being behaviour that is conceived as of being socially unacceptable at the time, and also, particularly in Lang's terms, it argues for madness as a form of resistance to the madness of society, which I hope will recollect to you the pieces I was reading from the case of Bill Williams. I think I'd also like to make a claim, aside from the case of Bill Williams as a political anti-psychiatric statement, for Kavan's fiction in many ways as being an anti-psychiatric statement. Her portrayals of the relationship between psychiatrist and patient, her portrayals of the asylum experience, I think very much argue against that traditional form of psychiatry. And so it's interesting that Binswanger reads Kavan, that Kavan is treated by Binswanger, and Binswanger is a strong influence on Odilei. The work of Maxwell Jones that he would go on to do after Kavan worked with him on the therapeutic community was also a strong influence on Audie Lang. Maxwell Jones was one of the people that Lang invited to his own therapeutic community, Kingsley Warne Hall, to dine there. And so, I think to conclude, I think this is the end of my talk. So to conclude, really, the story of Kavan and her mind doctors, I hope, gives a more rounded view of her as an intellectual and as a politically connected person, rather than simply a very solipsistic writer who was concerned only with things that happened to herself. I'd like to make a call for her to be seen as an intellectual and as somebody who was trying to make a statement about the isolated and dispossessed psychiatric patient. I think I'll wrap up there because I'm over time.
Thank you very much.
Thank
you. Any questions from the floor?
It's in the British Library.
Oh, good.
I
also read her introduction to one of the reprints.
Oh, yes. Are you Virginia?
Virginia, yes.
Hi.
But I was wondering what you actually mean by anti-psychiatric, because that quote that you gave of her describing Binswanger's approach sounded as if she was actually anti-analysis and like this very much as up-to-date idea of being treated as an equal. You said that there was none of this mystifying stuff and keeping you in the dark. I don't quite know what you mean by anti-psychiatry. It's obviously a term that's quite common among the psychiatric community. Are you trying to say she was keen on a more therapeutic approach?
Yes, I think so. But I think further than that, that yes, she was more keen on a more sort of person-to-person way of treating psychiatric issues, but also that she was making an argument for not necessarily treating aberrant behaviour as madness, an argument for some of what might be called madness being just something that's socially unacceptable, views that are socially unacceptable. I think it was difficult for her coming back to London as a pacifist. That was quite an extraordinary thing to be, I think, during the Second World War, and politically difficult. You find in her, in some of her stories, when she's sort of going over this, especially in the Lazarus stories, she talks about people sort of looking on or her characters being considered as a bit crazy, really just because they're holding views that don't fit in with the social norm. So I think that was those are the two strands that I was sort of trying to combat with antipsychiatry. Firstly, a call for a less invasive, more person-centred type of therapy, but also call for maybe exploding the categorisations of madness. Yeah.
Having just talked about exploding categories of madness, but could you say something about what were the symptoms of her psychiatric breakdowns, or what kind of was her experience, or how it was perceived, or what was her illness, even though it was the same, but it's sort of a healthy reaction to madness?
Well, yeah, I mean, so the other side of the argument is that, you know, some of her psychiatric problems were very debilitating. So, depression is the one thing that is consistently mentioned in her correspondence. I know certainly the Jeremy Reed biography suggests that she may have been manic depressive or that is suffered from bipolar disorder. I would really resist that sort of retrospective diagnosis. The only diagnosis that I see her referring to is of one of, and she puts it in quotation marks, obsessional suicide, which is a sort of bizarre diagnosis. Certainly, she does have numerous suicide attempts throughout her life. These seem to come with patches of severe depression. I don't get any sense in reading her correspondence that she suffered from what we might describe as mania. The highs that you might associate with something like that depression. It was mostly very debilitating depression and a drive to suicide.
But there are no records from Bellevue or from
Binswanger,
people that treated her?
Yeah, so Binswanger, there are Binswanger records. Binswanger doesn't diagnose. That's sort of not his method of treatment. The other thing that is also going on at the Bellevue and in a number of incarcerations is that she's been given the cure for her heroin addiction, she checks herself into nursing homes occasionally to come off heroin, but my sense is that's more for her to keep her addiction under some sort of control than because of a desire to sort of cut it out of her life entirely. So I have had permission to look at the Binswanger records, but again, they don't diagnose. I haven't seen any other psychiatric records of her.
Could you tell us just a little bit about the context of her writing at this time, and how well that was being received, and what, was she quite a public figure, and also this predominant friendship seemed to be obviously very, very much geared towards people who are involved or interested in psychiatry and therapy and psychoanalysis, but also they all seemed to have quite a creative underpinning to their interests too.
Yeah.
Was that her predominant group of friends and or associates in London and England at that time? Or did she also have a coterie of writers through the Horizon group that she talked with and developed ideas with as well?
So to answer the first part of your question, in terms of the reception of her writing, that was very mixed throughout her life. She really came to critical acclaim after she changed her name, and it's my belief that's the reason she decided to take the name Anna Cavan, because Anna Cavan had become a very well-respected writer. So Asylum Peace in 1940 and I Am Lazarus in 1945 were very well-received in intellectual circles. But to move later in the 1940s, she experimented with different styles that were less well received, and then she sort of hit a very dry patch and struggled to get published. Obviously, her final novel, Ice, in 1967, sort of brought her back to the attention of the world, and that sort of made her, in ways, a writer of her time. It was very popular at the time, although very different from her earlier work. She was very experimental. She was constantly trying out different styles. It didn't seem to matter to her what had gone down well. Previously, she was always sort of pushing the boundaries, wanting to do something different or re-experiment with something else. But in terms of her coterie, she did fall out with a lot of people throughout her life. I think she was a different... I mean, she was a difficult character to some extent. And so, certainly in London in the 1940s, which I focused on quite prominently here, she did mix with a very intellectual, creative circle, but those were, if they were friendships, they didn't last throughout her life. She became very reclusive later on. Blut was the one person who very much was a constant figure, although she did have her fallouts with him as well. And towards the end of her life, she was very friendly, with Rhys Davies, the Welsh writer. And it's very much his story of her life that I think has perpetuated the myth of her in a way. Rather than write a biography of her, which apparently was suggested to him, he wrote a fictionalised version of her life in, I think, 1975, called Honeysuckle Girl, which again confuses the narrative of her life, because it is a fictional version, and yet it's been drawn into the biographical accounts. So does that answer your question? It seems she comes into contact with some very interesting intellectual and creative circles, but she doesn't maintain that contact, or they don't maintain that contact with her.
I've come across some references to her writing from her peers who read them very, very lively, and I wonder then how she's become so sort of obliterated really from her work to our generation now.
See, that is one thing about Gavan. She is a writer's writer, which is a cliche, but it is writers who have continued to champion her work. Doris Lessing, most recently, has really, really brought her back to the forefront in her admiration. But, I mean, you only have to scratch the surface, you find many writers who are admirers of her. Jean Rhys, Brian Aldiss was a big admirer of hers. J.G. Ballard, obviously, you have that letter in the exhibition. But also more contemporary writers I'm finding now. Maggie G, my sense is, was interested and read her. Deborah Levy, also very interesting contemporary writer, with an interesting Gavan. So writers love Gavan.
Brian?
He was killed in the Second World War. He was a paratrooper. And what's interesting is Gavan never mentions him in her letters to Hamilton. And I wonder if he actually knew about her first marriage and her son. And there's been a suggestion that Gavan, which I think is very damning, was uninterested in her own children. But I think my research has suggested that perhaps her access to those children was just limited. Certainly her collection of photographs prominently feature pictures of Brian, as he's growing up, time that she's spending with him, and a photograph of him in his paratrooper's uniform. But he was killed. And she never mentions the fact that happens in her letters and around that time, but her letters just stop for a while. And she suffers a period of severe ill health. And I wonder if, the news of that had a profound effect on her. But that's all we know about.
I have two thought questions. Someone coming new to her, which of her books would you recommend perhaps as the most accessible?
Okay. Well, so in terms of recommending books, I think people find different things from Gavan because her style is so different at different periods. My personal favourites are her 1940s stories, so Iron Lazarus and Asylum Peace. But I think her most popular book is Ice, from 1967, which is quite different. And I think I always find Ice quite disturbing, actually. Although I do, the more I've read it, the more I've come to love it. But it has sort of elements of sexual violence in it, and a sort of sadomasochistic slant, which I think can be read very interestingly, but I've always found that quite disturbing. So it depends on your tastes, really. I would recommend the stories because I love them. Also, her posthumously published collection, Junior in the Bazooka, I think contains some of her best writing as well, so I would definitely recommend that. And so in terms of my doing more work on her, yes, I'm definitely continuing my research because there are still the holes there, I think. And I'm really keen to promote this, a newer narrative of Fern as a writer, as an intellectual. She's very much been discussed previously as an enigma and a secret, and I think actually she's not. There are things that we don't know about her. But there's more to be said, I think. So yes, I'm continuing my research and hope to maybe publish on her again. Thanks.
Would others agree with sort of favourites or recommending books to start?
You during the book, because the one I always push on to is
Unwilling. Excuse the pun.
She can be difficult or uncomfortable reading. She's not... People sort of say, oh, what do you recommend? I'm going on holiday. And I think, I really don't know what to say to that. I'm not sure that she'd be treating.
I agree, I wouldn't recommend Ice.
Exactly. It just, I mean, it sort of depends on your taste. Different people, but people love her. I mean, her fans love her. There is a real, especially on the internet now, you know, you get a real sense of people who are reading her. And people are passionate about different works which might not necessarily be my favourites. You know, people really feel that she is speaking to them in some way and that she's capturing a truth of despair. And I think that's the thing that keeps her being read and keeps that sort of that passion for her work going.
Just going back to the sort of literary side, I mean, just sort of thinking about, I think I read that she's compared with or associated with, say, perhaps. Do we know anything about who she admired? I'm not getting a sense that kind of she sort of read a lot and took on sort of the literary heritage before she sort of saw herself
Delved into that's... writing.
And so I'm wondering who she admired or who inspired her.
So she read very widely, very widely. She had very Catholic tastes. So this is why, I mean, she very much admired Kafka. I think that's clear from her writing. And the other high literary modernists, Eliot was a huge favourite of hers. Not George Eliot, sorry, T.S. Eliot, forgive me. T.S. Eliot. Also, she was a big admirer of Virginia Woolf, but she read very widely, and she was very undiscriminating, I think, with what she read. That's why I think towards the end of her life she was as interested in science fiction as she was in high literary fiction. She read a lot, and I think she was influenced by a lot. So it's difficult, really, to place her within a sort of a particular grouping, a literary grouping, because... You know, if you try to ally her and her work and her influences to one particular literary style or a particular group of writers, you're necessarily leaving out a lot of her other work, which might be aligned to other writers. So that's... I feel terrible if I've sort of given the impression that she didn't read widely. But I think it's also really difficult to try and categorise her in the literary sense. So as I say, she was a big fan of the high literary modernists. Kafka was an enduring love of hers. But then later, you know, she read very widely. She was very flattered to find out that Brian Aldiss admired her later work. She loved science fiction, loved Brian Aldiss. So it just seems to me that she read not just fiction, but non-fiction. She read very widely and was influenced very broadly.
Was there talk in her letters about her creative process? I mean, think like sort of letters, you know, about what she wanted to achieve, talking about how she saw her writing as different or how she placed it. Is there any kind of...
So, I guess in the archives, the most sense you get of her writing about her writing is in her letters to Peter Rowan, because he's her editor. But she very much talks about being affected by her life at that time. She felt, I think, with editors that they were trying to make her write in a Kavan-esque style, in the style that perhaps sold well the last time they published her. And she was very much pushing the idea that there was no way of writing for her, that the way she wrote was influenced by her life at that time. She could only write how she could write at that moment. That's something that she specifically said to Peter Owen when he was trying to make editorial suggestions to her. I mean, it's perhaps interesting to look at the manuscripts to get a sense of her creative process. My sense is that she wrote a lot and then reworked, and you can see that because she wrote in sort of big notebooks, and she writes out a lot, and then she goes back and edits through a lot. And I think, you know, I've argued very much against her writing as being autobiographical, but I think she did write down a lot of her impressions and then go back and rework them to be something fictional. Does that answer your question?
In a way, do you think? Yeah. I've only just come to her, so that just found it fascinating. Was there any sense when you were reading the psychiatrists, and they were all very male domain? Do you think because of the treatment she went through, did she find that many women were affected? Do you know that many women were being sort of treated in this way? Mm. And did she say anything about it?
So, that's a really interesting question, because Cavan, again, in the sort of biographical sources, has been in ways accused of being a sort of woman hater or a sort of anti-feminist in a way. And she doesn't focus on gender very specifically, which I think isn't to say that we can't read her writing as being quite feminist. Certainly in her earlier books, when she's describing women's lived experiences, she really... there's a real sense of the restrictions put upon women in their lives. And I think that, you know, she makes quite a feminist statement there in the way that she portrays women's lives and the restrictions upon them. The interesting thing about her psychiatric patient characters is that they're not all women. I guess there's at least as many men as there are women. So I don't get the sense that she's specifically writing about the female psychiatric patient's experience. And I think, you know, she was very, very focused on the idea of the individual. And I think in ways that meant she didn't really plug into identity politics, even sort of later in the 1960s, you know, when the women's movement was obviously, you know, very much at the forefront. You don't get any sense of her engaging with that, but my sense of her is that she's always talking about the individual person, and so gender doesn't come into it perhaps as much as would be interesting. So I hope that's not disappointing.
No, not at all. Yeah. You know how sometimes people, when they have had psychiatric experiences and have been in all sorts of institutions, sometimes the modern view is that women have been very sort of damaged. Mm. I quite understand what you're saying. That, no, she saw everything. She saw people as individuals.
Yeah.
So what happened?
Yeah.
It's just I've only read Julian's. Her description of the woman is just extraordinary.
Could you perhaps just tell us a little more about Bluth as well? And do you think of him as a significant relationship in her life, certainly the most sort of prolonged in her adult life? And you mentioned that he was also the psychiatrist to George Barker, to Kussler. I mean, here it's sort of stellar names in literature who also have very interesting lives where they don't fix to individuals either. There's sort of some quite fluid in their personal relationships. Were there any other women that he had as long-term patients? And was his relationship with Anna Cavan special for him in the range of his other clients and patients?
So there are very few records to sort of back this up, but it's interesting. I hadn't thought that actually I know of no other women patients. Definitely his relationship with Cavan, I think, was special for him. He wasn't friends with all of his patients. And I do get the sense that he was, in ways, the most, as you mentioned, the most significant relationship in her life. When he died in 64, she wrote, which was never published in its entirety, a couple of the stories were published, were collected, but she wrote a whole series of stories about their relationship, but they were fictional, and she specifically mentions that it's autobiographically based, but it's fictional. And you really get a sense from those stories of her feelings of absolute devastation that he left her. And she felt, I think, in a way, which I guess was part of her grieving process, she felt deserted by him, that he was the one person, her one friend in the world, and he had gone. Certainly she describes him in letters as my greatest friend for many years. So they did have a very special relationship. I mean, it's interesting that he had so many the influential, interesting patients, and yet we know so little about his treatment method. I mean, I only wonder how many other people he was prescribing heroin to. I don't know. Mm-hmm.
Is there a biography of Blut?
I think maybe in Germany there is. I mean, not in existence, sorry. I took your question to mean, is there... Could there be one?
Yes.
But no, there isn't. He's very, very under-researched, very, very interesting.